It was, Mark Hall said later, a horrifying experience. In an instant, I was taken from the most familiar of worlds and plunged into the most unfamiliar. Like most surgeons, Hall was insistent upon routine. Everything had to be done in a certain order, in a certain way. If not, he became upset. Because the others in the operating room knew this, they looked up toward the overhead viewing gallery with apprehension when Levitt appeared. Levitt clicked on the intercom that connected the upstairs room to the operating room below and said, "Hello, Mark." Hall had been draping the patient, placing green sterile cloths over every part of the body except for the abdomen. He looked up with surprise. "Hello, Peter," he said. "Sorry to disturb you," Levitt said, "but this is an emergency." "Have to wait," Hall said. "I'm starting a procedure."
"Kelly will take over for you," Levitt said.
"It's all arranged.
I'll expect to meet you in the surgeon's change room in about 30 seconds.
Hall glared at everyone in the room. No one moved or spoke. After a moment, he stripped off his gloves and stomped out of the room, swearing once very loudly. Hall viewed his own association with Wildfire as tenuous at best. In 1966, he had been approached by Levitt, the chief of bacteriology of the hospital, who explained in a sketchy way the purpose of the project. Hall found it all rather amusing and had agreed to join the team if his services ever became necessary. Privately, he was confident that nothing would ever come of Wildfire. For his own part, Peter Levitt was irritated with Hall. In general, Levitt had little patience with practicing physicians. Though he had an MD degree, Levitt had never practiced, preferring to devote his time to research. His field was clinical microbiology and epidemiology, and his specialty was parasitology. Within the hospital, he was known as a superb clinical bacteriologist, but his real interest was parasites. Levitt's reputation had made him a natural choice for Wildfire, and it was through Levitt that Hall had been asked to join. Levitt knew the reasons behind Hall's selection, though Hall did not. When Levitt had asked him to join, Hall had demanded to know why. "I'm just a surgeon," he said.
"Yes," Levitt said, "but you know electrolytes."
"So?"
"That may be important. Blood chemistries, pH, acidity, alkalinity, the whole thing. It may be vital when the time comes."
"But there are a lot of electrolyte people," Hall had pointed out, "and many of them better than me."
"Yes," Levitt had said, "but they're all married."
"So what?"
"We need a single man."
"Why?"
"It's necessary that one member of the team be unmarried."
"That's crazy," Hall had said.
"Maybe," Levitt had said. "Maybe not."
At 9:59 a.m. on the same morning, a K-4 jet helicopter lifted off the concrete of Vandenberg's maximum security hangar, MSH-9, and headed east toward Arizona. Inside the helicopter were three men, a pilot and two scientists, and all three wore clear plastic inflatable suits, making them look like obese men from Mars. The two passengers in the belly looked at each other. One was Jeremy Stone, the other Charles Burton. Both men had arrived at Vandenberg just a few hours before, Stone from Stanford and Burton from Baylor University in Houston. Burton was 54, a pathologist. He held a professorship at Baylor Medical School and served as a consultant to the NASA Manned Space Flight Center in Houston. Earlier, he had done research at the National Institute in Bethesda. His field had been the effects of bacteria on human tissues. As a result of his work with Staphylococcus aureus, a common skin pathogen responsible for pimples and boils, new strains of which were later found to cause bizarre deaths, his grant appropriation jumped to $300,000 a year. Looking back, Burton felt no great pride in his accomplishment. It was, he knew, a matter of luck, of being in the right place and doing the right work when the time came. Sitting across from him, Jeremy Stone tried to conceal his distaste for Burton's appearance. Beneath the plastic suit, Burton wore a dirty plaid sport shirt with a stain on the left breast pocket. His trousers were creased and frayed, and even his hair, Stone felt, was unruly and untidy.
50 people, Stone said, shaking his head. Dead within 8 hours of the landing of Scoop 7. The question is one of spread.
Presumably airborne, Burton said.
Yes, presumably.
Even if you slit a man's throat with a razor, Burton said, you won't get death that rapidly. Cutting both cartoids and jugglers still allows 10 to 40 seconds before unconsciousness and nearly a minute before death.
At Piedmont, it seems to have occurred in a second or two. Over the intercom, the helicopter pilot said, "Piedmont, approaching, gentlemen. Please advise." Stone said, "Circle once and give us a look at it." The helicopter banked steeply. The two men looked out and saw the town below them. The buzzards had landed during the night and were thickly clustered around the bodies. "I was afraid of that," Stone said.
"They may represent a vector for infection spread," Burton said. "Eat the meat of infected people and carry the organisms away with them."
Stone nodded, staring out the window.
"What do we do?"
"Gas them," Stone said. The helicopter tilted and swung back. Soon the two men could not see the ground for the clouds of pale blue gas.
"What is it?"
"Chlorazine," Stone said. "Highly effective in low concentrations on aviary metabolism." The gas slowly cleared in the gentle wind moving off to the south. Soon they could see the ground again. Hundreds of birds lay there. A few flapped their wings spastically, but most were already dead. Stone frowned as he watched. Somewhere in the back of his mind, he knew he had forgotten something, or ignored something, some fact, some vital clue that the birds provided and he must not overlook.